It's Sunday, July 14th, 2013. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. We're here for another episode of Radio Free Nintendo, and I've got my boys, Guillaume Veillette.
Hello.
John Lindemann.
Johnny Metz, my favorite host in the universe.
Oh, thank you, man. And Mr. James Jones.
Since when do we announce the date for the episode the show's coming out?
Well, so I wanted to mention that. That's a tribute to our dear departed idol and hero, Mr. Ryan Davis.
Oh.
Yes, the host, former host of the Giant Bombcast, one of my favorite shows. And I know a lot of our listeners are also fans. And, you know, I think even if you have never seen a video of Ryan Davis, if you've never heard one of his podcasts or read something that he wrote, you probably were exposed to some of the outpouring from the past week.
Oh, definitely. All over my Twitter feed.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. It's because people really like that guy. And it was pretty shocking. And it's weird even because, like, on the Giant Bombcast, they frequently talk about, like, you know, what happens when people die in this day and age? Like, what happens to your Xbox Live account? What happens to all your Steam catalog of games and stuff like that? You know, like, what happens to your Facebook account? You know, it just, I don't know. It's given me a lot to think about. It's been incredibly distracting all week. And you know, Ryan is not a guy I knew personally, but he's a guy I've listened to for hundreds of hours. So, you know, it has an effect on you when someone who's I'm at least familiar with him, you know, across a very broad spectrum of topics and of video games, and, have spent a lot of time watching him on, you know, live shows that they do at Giant Bomb. And so when you see someone who really, and of course he's not acting. I mean, he's out there with, that's his real personality. Like, that's who he is. He's really putting himself out there. And, when somebody does that for as long as he did and does it so incredibly effectively, you really feel like you have some weird kind of one-way connection with that person. And it affected me emotionally in a way that, really took me by surprise. He was 34 years old, and
he just got married.
And just got married, yeah. Like 4 days later, 4 days earlier. It's so crazy. And you know, I mean, the last time I heard him speak was talking about E3 right after the show. You know, the last time I saw him was at PAX East, where he drank breast milk that someone hand delivered to him from the front row.
I don't
row.
Want that to be the memory that we drum up for him.
That is absolutely the memory, because he was that crazy and he was that funny and he was just willing to do anything. And anyway, I don't want to harp on it. I'm sure you're going to hear about it on other podcasts. And the Giant Bombcast actually just released an episode.
Yeah,
where, you know, the remaining members of that crew are talking about him, and I haven't listened to it yet, and I don't know, in a way I'm kind of dreading even experiencing that, because I can't imagine how devastating it's going to be to listen to them talk about their friend and colleague like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I listened to some of it. I listened to quite a bit of it, but you know, I moved to towards the end, and it has highs and lows.
Yeah, kind
of
sure.
It's kind of a tough listen. It's a tough listen for sure.
It's going to be brutal.
To sort of put it in context for us, I remember the last episode Greg did. We had people email us saying they cried. Now imagine
hell, we were a little shaky even while recording it, and
I was
like,
I was all dead, man. Okay. I was ball bearing testicles, man. It was fine.
Yeah.
You go with that story, James. The proof is out there for anyone to listen to.
But like, I can't imagine, like, that show wasn't a big part of my life, but people who listen to that show, I mean, we got emails just because he left. I mean, I can't imagine what that's like.
Yeah.
But I mean,
as a fan, I can tell you it hit me really hard, and it's still hitting me. I still haven't fully processed it.
From a larger standpoint, though, I do wonder, you know, what that means for that site as a whole, because he really was, you know, the major
co-founder.
I mean, he was one of the two people who set what that site was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be kind of weird for them. I have to imagine that's going to be a really tough transition period.
Yeah. It's, I don't even want to think about that stuff yet. I just,
Yeah, I know.
I have it, but I got home from work last night and started just watching some videos. Like there was a Tumblr page that Nate Andrews tweeted to me, and it's just people posting their favorite Giant Bomb videos of Ryan, and they're all friggin' hilarious. It's like him shaking the baby from Babysitting Mama, and
yeah, you know, I watched the Mad Dog McCree one.
Oh, God. Oh man,
that is brilliant.
Like to see his like ecstatic delight rolling around on the ground when he first hears the song that Buckner and Garcia did for Giant Bomb, where they say that GiantBomb.com cured Pac-Man fever. Like, that is so weird and obscure and bizarre. And like, you can totally put yourself in his shoes and think, like, this band that he grew up listening to their corny novelty disco songs is now writing a song about his website. Like, how would that even feel? You know, so it's just truly a delightful human being, and someone I wish I had known much better than I did. But you know, that fucking sucks.
Yeah, so, it does. That's pretty much sums it up.
But what a legacy he left, and if you just look at the reactions from people, you can see that he did what he did very well, and he made a lot of people very happy. Let's move on. Just wanted to give a little bit of time to that, but we have a really great packed show for you guys. We've got new business. We're going to talk about a ton of brand new games, actually, and a lot of really Japanese games this week. That's just kind of the way it worked out.
Yeah, you got to change your new business here, because we want an all Japanese podcast here.
We have out Japan Famicast. This is a dangerous precedent we've set.
Yeah,
and these aren't like slightly Japanese games. These are
they're way Japanese.
These are like deep ass Nihon territory here.
Yeah, like kanji all over the screen. I mean, you know.
I mean, this
kanji
is...
tattoos. You know, like, you know, they were cool. They were cool at one time when I was a kid.
I mean, this is, we might as well just go ahead and call this segment like Atarashi Game, and just be done with it. Just fucking throw the Japanese straight in. It's fine.
These games are so Japanese, they didn't even bother translating the titles when they released them in America.
I mean, for God's sakes, my game is still in Japanese!
So, alright, so Guillaume is actually gonna kick it off. He's got the brand newest game, and one that I know a lot of our fans are gonna be excited to hear about.
Yeah, well, I hope so. This game is so new, it's not out yet. Shin Megami Tensei 4.
Yeah, I think it comes out the day that the podcast will be published.
Stop going to the future, Mets!
but yeah, like, it wasn't released at the time that I got it. Neil was kind enough to give me one of the codes that we got for the website. Unfortunately, I've been in the process of moving, and let me tell you that you can try to download a 2 gigabyte file at a McDonald's, but it's not recommended.
Yeah.
It took me forever to download it, and I haven't played perhaps as much as I would have liked. I'm about like 7 hours into the game, but it's good. It's good. So yeah, as we've mentioned, Shin Megami.
Did you actually say what the name of the game is?
He did. Yeah, Shin Megami Tensei 4.
Sorry, I was spacing for a second.
Oh, he was speaking Japanese, Johnny.
It's right. It's hard. Yeah.
It must have been my perfect accent that threw you off. I pronounced it the way a Japanese person would.
Yeah.
Yeah, as we mentioned, the name is unlocalized, and I think that to a lot of people, that means stay away, you know? Like,
but there's other reasons to stay away.
Well, maybe.
Well, to me, it might say this might be a bit too dense or impenetrable for your taste.
It probably would be more inviting if they translated the name to True Goddess Reincarnation, but I think they're actually doing you a service here.
Maybe so, but I think just keeping the Japanese name also gives it a cool factor for a certain audience, and that certain audience is probably exactly who they're going for.
Oh, yeah, God, yes. Well, that's probably what they were thinking at the beginning. Atlus probably thought, okay, we already have people familiar with the strange Japanese series, like they've heard about them, all the otaku in North America know about this series. We're going to keep the title and we're going to appeal to them. But now that the series has grown quite a bit, and I'm sure that Atlus would like to see their audience grow quite a bit as well, I think that probably the title is kind of a barrier, because you read Shin Megami Tensei and you're like, what the fuck? What is this? And but it turns out that at least the fourth game, the one on 3DS, is pretty approachable. Like, it's pretty surprising. Well, first, like, the story is that it's an RPG. And the story is that you play this kind of this kid who goes to town to pass a test, and the very few people who pass the test become samurai, and so you become a samurai, and then they give you a gauntlet that's actually very like future technology and that can summon demons, and this is all news to the kid, you know, like this is not common knowledge. And so, like, already you can tell that, oh, okay, this series is going to go in weird places, and I thought I was in feudal Japan, but, you know, with, you know, demons just being summoned digitally, it's probably, there's probably something else at work here. Unfortunately, I'm still stuck in feudal Japan. Apparently, once you get into, like, further into the game, you reach basically modern day Tokyo or future Tokyo, and the game opens up quite a bit and there is plot twist after plot twist, but so far the game has been pretty straightforward. And what I do appreciate is that the gameplay has also been straightforward. I was afraid getting into the game that perhaps I would be hitting my head against like menus and really obscure stuff. Like I was afraid that it would require more knowledge than I have about the series. But right away, like, everything is super well explained. Every menu is very, like, everything, as soon as you select something, it tells you what it does, which is great when you're just trying to get into the series. There's a ton of tutorials. They're even a little bit intrusive initially. Like, you can skip them, but you don't want to, just in case they tell you something really that you didn't know before, and that's really important. But yeah, like, eventually the tutorials give way to the gameplay, and it's pretty satisfying. One of the main characteristics of this series that's been there since the beginning is that you don't really create a party, but you basically bribe or coerce or, try to fool demons into fighting with you. And these demons compose your party. And in that way, it's a little bit like Pokemon, except that, you know, instead of fighting them and whittling down their health, before trying to capture them, you're actually conversing with them. And you have the most like weird and absolutely crazy conversations with them. I think I gave the example before of like one demon who was impressed when I told him that I used to be a bug. But you've got like other ones that like, they'll ask you like, hey, you, come here, come over here, friend. And you have the option to get closer or to run away. And so for one of them, I ran away and was like, oh, what? Is there danger here? And then it ran away itself. Or, you know, like they've all got very different, reactions to the things you say or the things you do. And it's up to you to kind of figure out, okay, what do I need to do here? Like, what kind of demon is this? Will it respect me if I give it, tons of gifts, or instead, like, is it actually going to be turned off by that? Am I supposed to be like, no way, you're not getting anything, you're just following me? And, you know, like, I'm saying this right now, like, I know it sounds really, really, like, you're probably always constantly in the dark of what these demons want and everything, but you can figure out pretty easily. It's not like you have like one shot of capturing one and then that's it. Like they'll keep the conversation going, and like little by little, the more you speak to one type of demon, you get to know like, oh, okay, like here I gave the right answers, but then I gave it too many gifts, and next time I just have to fix that. So yeah, like it's very original. I like the setting, you know, like it's not a. I think that the setting has a lot of promise.
But the setting you've been playing is not really the setting that most of the game is, right?
Yeah. But I know a little bit. I try not to spoil myself, but I know a little bit, you know, where the story's going to go next. And that kind of stuff interests me. Like, I do like the idea of playing an RPG that's not set in medieval times, or, you know, that's not in the kind of tired fantasy setting. Unfortunately, though, like, as much as I want, as I do like the setting, and as much as I want to really, really love this game, there's a couple of things that are already kind of holding it back. We actually have a review right now on the Nintendo World Report.
Save it for the segment.
One of the pros at the end of a review is great voice acting, and I don't want to be, you know, like I don't want to call anyone out here, but I'm just wondering. I'm guessing that I have very, very different standards from some other people, because the voice acting has been pretty piss poor. It's got like this kind of hammy overacting, especially the side characters who, you know, you end up talking to a lot of them. Like, you'll be talking to peasants during voice cutscenes, and they'll just be like, oh no, oh, the demons, no. And you're,
but, you know, I do wonder how much of that is just being cheesy.
There could be some of that, but it's not consistent throughout.
I mean,
right?
This series is super self-aware.
I don't know. Like, it's supposed to be kind of a poignant scene. Like, you're in your protagonist's village, and demons have invaded it, and your neighbors are being killed. But that's not what it sounds like. It just sounds like there's no emotion there. You know, it's just some guy reading lines. I don't think they're playing it for laughs. You know, it's just.
I think Guillaume just needs to learn Japanese and just import his games. It'll be fine.
Maybe. I would compare like the voice acting to something like Trauma Team or Trauma Center, which is also by Atlus.
Yeah.
Well, I see. I mean, that game is just silly, though.
Yeah. And the voice acting is not absolutely atrocious for the most part.
I'd call it hammy.
Yeah.
Alucardian.
It's very knowing, but it is certainly hammy in the sense that it's a little over dramatic.
There's a wink and a nod in a lot of the delivery in Trauma Team.
Yeah. Which is maybe a way to get around not actually being that great of an actor, or maybe just kind of a way of dealing with writing that's not amazing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people they hired for Trauma Team, though, are established voice actors. I think they were just gave him a really dumb script, and they're like, okay, this is supposed to be silly. He's a surgeon who's also a superhero. Figure it out.
Yeah, and in Shin Megami Tensei 4, you'll recognize as soon as you hear him, the character that's voiced by Nolan North. But just having Nolan North in your game does not mean it's going to have like a great voice acting.
No, it usually means the opposite.
But yeah, like that's one other thing though. Like, we mentioned the writing, and I don't think it's very good at all. Like, it's got, just like in Trauma Center, again, in Trauma Team, like the voice acting is very much like one actor speaks and then another actor speaks. And there's always like this long transition between lines because that's, I don't know, I guess that's how the cutscenes are set up. And this happened in this game as well, but in the writing, they don't take that into account. So you'll have one character just say, like, trail off before finishing the sentence, or he's being cut off, but you've got this 1 second pause, and then the guy cutting him off speaks. You know, like, it doesn't work well at all. Thankfully, you don't have really, really obscure vocabulary like in Final Fantasy 13 with like the Falci and the Lassie, and you don't have to keep an index near you, but there are some terms specific to the game that are just ridiculous. Like, the whole story so far seems to center between this clash between two classes. Get this, the casualry and the luxurers.
Perfect.
This is like the high class, the low class of this
world. I'm okay
world.
With it. I'm okay with it. I'm good.
Seriously?
On this.
When I saw casualry, I turned to, I think it was like the guys, the localizer of this game. I actually asked him, like, oh, okay, like, was this a typo? And he said no. And I didn't know how to react. Like, I hope my face didn't show anything. I don't know. I'm not that impressed. And, I'm probably not going to keep playing this game for the story, but the mechanics are really, really fun in combat. You're constantly dealing with these demons, and, you know, like, talking to the demons is way more interesting and way more fun and way better written than, you know, any cutscenes involving other humans.
So just as an aside, if you're kind of on the fence about this game and you've already bought Fire Emblem.
Ooh, yeah.
And you live in North America. Mm-hmm. You can actually, if you register this game on Club Nintendo and you've already registered Fire Emblem by the end of August, you get $30 eShop credit. Which is a very interesting promotion on Nintendo's part that they're doing so much to hype a game by another company. Mm-hmm. Granted, there is that crossover of Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei that's coming out someday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's a ways out. It's a very odd move by Nintendo as a company, to be honest. I'm not sure what the pro is for them here. Unless they're secretly planning to buy the now bankrupt Atlas.
Hmm. Well, maybe Shin Megami Tensei was cheaper than Dragon Quest. I'd rather think that it was like not one or the other, but they've been helping other developers by publishing their games.
Atlas publishes one themselves. They localize.
Yeah, I know. Like this seems to be perhaps another kind of partnership instead of just like taking over the publishing. They're just like, okay, we'll do something with you, with Fire Emblem.
We're going to give you an absolutely enormous boost. I mean, it's $30 eShop credit on what, a $40 game?
It's a $50 game.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that a little later in the show, but I think it's very interesting. It's a great deal. I mean, if you are interested in these games, it's awesome, you know, that they're doing this. I think it's very smart for them. The other thing you have to keep in mind is I think it's super interesting that it's even if you buy the physical copies of both games, you still get this eShop credit.
Yeah. That was my next question.
It's super smart because it takes, you know, a lot of people still aren't on board with the eShop for various reasons. And some people have very legitimate criticisms about the lack of an account system and digital content security, et cetera.
And the fact that I don't own my games.
Sure. But, you know, there are so many things available on eShop now. $30 could get you several games, or it could get you one really big game that might throw you all the way in the deep end. So it's a great Trojan horse for Nintendo to get people to use the eShop. It's also something that costs them virtually nothing, because eShop credit isn't real money. It's not like they're mailing you a check for $30. You're probably going to download something that you never would have downloaded anyway. So it costs them nothing.
It does cost them some money, though, because they have – if you buy – well, it depends on what you buy. If you buy a Nintendo game, no, it doesn't. But if you buy a third-party game, they need to transfer money to that third party to represent their cut of the sale.
You know, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, you're right, but they're still going to keep their part of it for the licensing
fee. Right, I mean, it costs them less than $30. But if you buy a third-party game – it's going to cost them some amount of money.
Sure, but also the likelihood is, you know, the average person you give an eShop credit to, they're going to spend it on something first party anyway.
Probably,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you can argue that there's an opportunity cost, but again, I would say a lot of the people who are going to get and use this eShop credit either don't use the eShop at all, or they're going to use it as an excuse to get something that they probably wouldn't have bought anyway, or certainly not unless it was on sale.
And while I'm probably, like, I know I'm in the extreme minority here, like, they are selling a couple of copies of Fire Emblem to people. Like, I still hadn't picked up Awakening, and this will kind of light a fire under my ass to do so. Like, I was in no hurry to do so. And
I mean, you can get it out there for $35 now, so effectively you're getting Fire Emblem for $5 if you look at it that way.
That's how Nintendo wants you to look at it that way. Yeah, it's not exactly the reality, but yeah.
That's not the reality, but I mean, it's still money that you don't have to spend.
It's basically a free season pass to the Fire Emblem DLC, which I'll just go buy and be done with.
It's
just play all the dumbass DLC.
So John, your logic is only correct if you are someone like Guillaume, or like probably any of us, where we would have spent $30 on the eShop in the future at some point. And so this basically will just go against what we would have spent in our own money at some point. But what I just to be clear for people so they don't get confused, you cannot retroactively use that $30 credit on one of the two games. So
correct. It's like the Amazon $10 off card.
Right. You can only use it on something above and beyond the two games that you bought to get the credit in the first place.
Correct.
So it's not like you're not getting Fire Emblem or Shin Megami Tensei for free, or even at a discount. You're getting something else for free or at a discount. Something in a third or fourth or fifth game.
Don't get inside my head. I'm the backlog king. I'll justify shit any way I want.
That's right. Or you get $30 of free DLC from Fire Emblem games.
Yeah. All right. So, Guy, I'm sure we will hear from you again on this topic at some point.
Oh, definitely.
You got a lot more to go on that game. But let's move on to Mr. Lindemann, who also has a new game, a Japanese game, and a Nintendo game.
Well, I thought I would continue our tour of Japan, Johnny, with Kokuga. Of course, Kokuga was it's a game that was directed by Hiroshi Inuchi, who is the designer of Radiant Silver Gun and the director of Ikaruga. So, of course, this piqued my interest, being a big fan of both those games. And it's quite different from both of those games, let me say.
I mean, conceptually it is. I mean, you pilot a tank, correctly?
Yes, you pilot a tank, and it's set in sort of like now, granted, I've gone through the first two levels, and that's it. I think there's 30, but game's fairly difficult. Actually, not really difficult, but you have to get through it on one life. So you have to get through each area, which is kind of like almost like a VR mission styled sort of kind of grid obstacle course. If you want to look at if you want to talk about the kind of visual style of the game,
like
I think back to the Metal Gear VR missions where it's all green grid sort of, you know, or like you know, moving walls that are just like solid gray
90s virtual reality.
Yes, exactly.
This isn't bad graphics. It's virtual reality.
This isn't lazy.
This is high tech.
Yes, it's so I have to say, overall, I am quite disappointed by Kokuga. Part of the reason is the fact that it was $15 on the eShop, and I would probably have been disappointed if I would have paid $5 for it.
Whoa! Which, it's funny, because in Japan, I think it's actually significantly more expensive. So it's also an eShop game in Japan, but I think they priced it at something, it's closer to like $25 or $30, I want to say.
Wow. So, yeah. So, my beef with it. All right, you are a tank. My problem is that it plays very slowly. It's completely not the kind of game that I would expect it to be. So that's
Does it auto scroll, or is it kind of more free roaming where you just kind of move in any direction however you want to?
It's free roaming, so you get to choose which path you take, which enemies you go after. But my problem with it is, you shoot very slowly. So you're a tank, and your tank actually behaves like a tank. The main game mechanic is that, you have your little pew pew kind of cannon, which actually is kind of powerful. But the thing is, it shoots very slowly, so it's kind of like pew.
Is it
pew?
Yeah. Is it pew, like one projectile at a time on the screen?
Pretty much.
It's a single pew.
The controls are shooting with B. That's it. And you move your turret around 360 degrees counterclockwise or clockwise using the left and right shoulder triggers.
Okay. Could you use a touch screen if you wanted?
Yes, you can. That's one of the key things. But the turret is also very slow. It takes you 4 seconds to do a complete 360 with the turret.
Oh, you timed it.
Yes, it was that fucking slow.
Research.
I had to time it. I'm like, oh my god, this has to be timed. I want to know how long this takes. So, where the touch screen comes into play is you're given cards. You're given 12 cards per area, per level. And you can choose them. You have 4 at a time that you can use. They are chosen randomly, and you can use them however you see fit. And so you can select from. So you touch them to enable them. So you have a force field. You have triple shot, homing shot. You have like napalm, which is a bomb that hits everything on the screen. You have one called the final weapon, which hurts you and takes your health down to almost nothing but destroys everything on the screen. So you have a laser that forms a circle around you so you can, like, you know, kind of move towards enemies and kill them as you hit them. You have a laser that you can move around 360 degrees and it just kills everything. So you have a lot of different choices, which is cool, but the problem with the way that the game mechanic is implemented is the way you play the game is you try to avoid having a lot of enemies on the screen because, like I said, your turret is slow, your shots are slow. So you really can't handle a whole bunch of enemies at once. You really can't do that. So you have to kind of like stay far away from them and pick them off right at the edges of the screen.
Oh, you're like feathering the camera view?
Pretty much, yeah. Ugh. That's kind of what it forces you to do.
That makes me ill, John.
Yeah,
Because
otherwise you'll just get creamed because the enemies just completely overwhelm you and you really can't react fast enough.
I used to do that in Crystalis in 1989.
Exactly, and that's what I don't like about it. So now, granted, you can get things, you know, pretty you can learn things pretty well because the enemies are always the same, and so you can kind of learn each level very well. So you can kind of anticipate where enemies are, so you can kind of get through them more quickly. But it really slows things down. And the way, and going back to the way the cards are implemented, the power ups, is you're constantly, because they're random, you're constantly looking down at the touch screen to see what it's given you. So you're constantly taking your eyes off the top screen, taking your eyes off the action, which if there's a lot of enemies or if you're fighting a boss, you really have to, you know, keep on top of what you're doing. And you're constantly looking down to see what you've been given, looking down, looking down, looking down. It's really frustrating. Really frustrating. And, you know, I asked some people on Twitter, I'm like, is this game always like this? I mean, is it always this slow and this frustrating? And they said, yeah, pretty much. I mean, really, like, the way I was playing was the way you have to play. You have to kind of stand back and pick enemies off one by one.
Is that their design? Is that what they think the gameplay should be? Or does it feel like you've just found some way to break the game?
No, I mean, it feels like the game forces you to do that. Because you can't really survive any other way.
I mean, do you think that was their intention? Or do you think that's just the only way it works?
I don't know. What, do you mean the power-up?
Yeah.
And can't you push a button to make the tank roll over and dodge bullets?
I don't know if you can do that.
Worked in Star Fox 64.
Yeah. as far as I know, there's nothing like that. I mean...
Because it seems like that would... If you had a way to dodge, then that might speed up and allow you to kind of blast into a group of enemies, you know, more recklessly, which would speed up the pace of the game.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if you might be missing something because it got a great review on our website. And you admitted you haven't played as much of it. So I'm wondering, is it that you need to spend more time and see more levels of it, or maybe you can't because I don't know. I mean, maybe it really does suck. I mean, I'm not questioning your criticism at all.
I asked the same question and I read the review and it didn't tell me anything I wasn't already seeing. So,
wow.
I mean,
they could just be different strokes then.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not Ikaruga. I can tell you that.
Certainly it's not good.
Certainly not that.
So do you regret not buying the other tank game, Bugs versus Tanks?
No one regrets not buying that game.
I can tell you that I regret paying more for this game than I did for Ikaruga on Xbox Live Arcade.
Now,
is amazing.
Which is $10. But now, yeah, isn't Bugs versus Tanks pretty damn good?
It's supposed to be pretty good, and it's $8.
Yeah, it's one of the Guild O2 games from Keiji Inafune.
Yeah, if I could get my $15 back, I would be willing to give it a try.
Now, what if you got $30 eShop credit from buying these other two games?
I wouldn't spend it on Kokuga, that's for damn sure.
Sean's going to buy Kokuga for all his friends.
You know, like, I was also looking forward to Kokuga, and I was looking forward to the release, and once it came out on the eShop, I went on the eShop, and it wasn't there. And then on Twitter,
you're Canadian.
Yeah, on Twitter, I saw that there was a reason for that, and the reason is because the developer or the publisher on Facebook posted something about how they didn't know, like there were some details about the eShop releases that they weren't made aware of until the last minute, and so that led to them not being able to sell the game on the Canadian eShop, which is really, really frustrating. And it's,
I would love to know what the details that they missed out on.
Well, it's really, like, I don't know. Like, there's some weird stuff happening lately because, on the eShop, on both the Wii U and 3DS, sometimes, not every game, but some games, will be like a couple of cents more expensive over here. And
it's
just
to pay some like point of sale tax in Canada and have to have an account set up.
I think it's calculating the exchange rate. But not every game does that. So it looks weird. Like there's like some weird options that publishers can click. And when you're, you know, in the case of assholes like Warner Brothers, apparently, they'll click the, you know, fix the exchange rate. So instead of paying like $59.99 for Injustice, you pay like 60 and 10 cents.
They click, so the team releasing this game clicks the Canada checkbox, I guess. I mean,
who knows?
The thing is, Kokuga is published by, it's self-published by the Japanese developer,
yes.
And so
GRev, yeah,
very likely something was lost in translation here, and I can almost guarantee you that Dan Adelman, the guy who runs the North American eShop, I'm sure he's on the case. And there's probably just some miscommunication.
He's probably thinking, God damn, why didn't they read the instructions?
I'm wondering if it has to do with maybe they didn't translate it into French or something.
I heard that, but...
It doesn't seem likely to me, because there are a lot of games that are not translated in French on the eShop, okay. And that's not a problem. And I'm not sure, I don't think they all have French manuals. But I think that perhaps the hang-up could be... The ESRB rating or something like that, like something really, really stupid. Like that, the descriptions are actually translated in French for I think all games. So it could be something stupid like that.
So anyways, yeah, so Kokuga, I'm willing to be convinced. Somebody out there, please convince me that this game is worth playing through. I also asked on Twitter, in my incredulity, do they switch up the graphics at all? And apparently not really a whole heck of a lot. A lot
I
of it
think
is
there's two
kind
environments.
Of VR mission stuff. And I think they switch over to industrial environments. I'm expecting a lot of gray.
Yeah, that's what the review said.
Yeah, so I'm willing to be convinced, but it's tough. It's tough because it sucks dropping $15 on a game and being like, wow, I really don't even feel like playing it past level 2.
Yeah, man, I feel for you. I hope someone figures out a way to convince you, you know, or I hope there's more to it than you've seen, right?
Yeah, I'm gonna keep playing through it just out of pure bitterness, but
that's the best way to enjoy your top down shooter.
So remember, if you can play a game and hate it,
James Jones is proof positive. Well, I can say that I like Nano Assault better than this. I can tell you that.
Yeah, Nano Assault is a damn good game.
It's a good game.
John's like, I enjoy chocolate more than I enjoy this game.
I enjoy breathing more than I enjoy this game.
I really enjoy going to a football game more than I enjoy this game.
But yeah.
Well, speaking of things that James really enjoys, let's move on to his game for new business.
Hi. Tsugi no Ekai wa Project Cross Zone desu.
Bless you.
I believe if my Japanese is still accurate, I just said the next train station is Project Cross Zone. But I'm sure somebody will write me and say I fucked up the pronunciation on something. That's fine. So I spoke about this a little bit in the past. I have the retail game. I have been playing it. I'm about 20-ish hours of playtime. My save is probably about 15 hours because of deaths, because I'm a buffoon. Who doesn't save mid-battle. And, all right, first off, as we've established, let's cover some ground rules as to what the fuck this game is, because it's worth doing. This is a game that exists, for some reason, that is a mix of characters from Sega, Namco, and Capcom universes who have been drawn together by some interdimensional rifts. Mm. And their reason to be is to figure out the source of these rifts and return to their home worlds. That's basically the paper-thin premise of this game. Now, it was unknown to me until relatively recently that this is actually a sequel to a game that came out on the PS2 in Japan called Namco, I believe it was Namco X Capcom, which is the exact same premise, but without Sega being involved. So this has happened before, and someone said, "No, this needs to come to America."
So this needs to happen again.
This is A.
Forget
this
the band
needs to happen
together,
with
people.
Sega, and B. It needs to be in the West. Both of these things probably weren't true statements, but here we are. So what this is? It's a strategy RPG game where you have two characters that are paired together. Usually they're of the same franchise. Sometimes they're complementary characters. A really good example is Frank West of
Dead Rising.
Dead Rising has been paired with the Dark Stalkers zombie. He's Sanko, whose special attacks, if you're familiar with that franchise, are she can store an infinite number of weapons in her sleeves. So the fact that he's paired with a Chinese zombie is in and of itself kind of a joke because he spends the whole game beating the shit out of zombies. But her infinite sleeves also serve as the maul for his character, so she's constantly providing him weapons to hit things with. It's really stupid. It's like a really dumb insular joke that maybe like 10 people in the West will get. But it's really that kind of clever stuff that's layered on top of what is a relatively competent strategy RPG.
Well, when you say relatively competent, I mean, you have
it's quite
a frame of reference here, James. So I mean,
right? I mean, it's not the most intricately, you know, laid out. I mean, it's a tactics game more than it is a strategy game. There is some strategy involved. You can manage choke points and things, but it's primarily a tactics game. It's not as complicated as a lot of members of its genre. You know, there's not. You can't really juggle classes and stats. Really, your only options are you can, you know, give a couple of really random items that are themed based on one of the worlds, like the grass skirt from Adventure Island. I mean, just random stuff. Like, you can just give it to people, and that boosts a stat in some way. And then the other way is you have these two characters, and you can pair them with a third character, the sort of, they call them single characters, that are just sort of floaters, and they can be swapped in and out of any two-character unit to give additional attacks per combat sequence and stat boosts and add skills to the party's repertoire of magic attacks or healing magic.
Okay, but does that feel, like, sufficiently different? Like, do you feel like this has an actual impact when you're fighting an enemy?
So, it depends on who you've paired. There's... Like, some of the single characters are significantly better than others, and you would expect that. So, Dante is paired with a vampire from Darkstalkers, which is funny in and of itself. And they know each other because apparently Dante knows all the Darkstalkers characters. But later you encounter another character from Dante's universe in the form of Lady. That's her name, if you haven't played Devil May Cry series.
I had a dog named Lady once.
Her name is actually...
I love that dog.
Her name is actually Lady, and she's kind of... And to John's point, she's kind of a bitch.
Well played.
The premise of her character is Dante owes her an absolute ton of money, and Dante's a lazy bastard and doesn't want to pay it back. But, like, she's kind of useless. But Tron from the Mega Man Legends series is amazing. It really depends on who you're dealing with. You get these, they add spells to the party's repertoire that let you heal or do stat buffs or let you debuff enemies. They gain extra attacks that allow you to, you know, that you can trigger during a battle strategically. They tweak the performance of the party. It's not a huge differentiation. Now, It's significantly different from them not having a third party member, but individually it's not a big deal. Where it comes into its own, and what this game is really banking on with the nostalgia, is the interactions that these two characters will pick up with this third interloper into their party. So, you know, a good example, I may have mentioned this from the demo, is that when Frank and Hee-Sung Ko are talking about Tron, she's in the party, Hee-Sung asks Frank, "Hey, do you think Tron can give us any futuristic weapons?" And Frank starts rattling off these Mega Man weapons that he'd really like to have. And her response is just an exasperated, "You've kind of thought about this, haven't you?" And there's lots of these little, like, weird one-offs that are written to be interactions between these characters that are kind of rewarding in their own right and sort of urge you to swap them around a bit just for the fun of it. Just to kind of see the dumb shit these characters are going to say to one another.
Mm-hmm. And can swap them, like, is it just at the start of a hour-long mission, or can you swap them during missions?
You could swap them between missions. They range in length. They have started to get into the hour-long territory. Actually, it seems like Tron has all the best ones. Arthur from Super Ghouls and Ghosts has some really good ones. And some of them related to his boxer shorts.
Nice.
The game itself, like I said, it's got some basic, you know, managing high ground strategy stuff. There's a little bit of tactics involved in making sure you get your attacks in the right order.
Is, like, the gameplay, is the challenge actually keeping your interest up, or is it just the interactions between the characters?
The challenge is a little bit. It's not that difficult. Really, what keeps my interest up is just where the hell is the story going to go next? Because after each mission, you're basically being shot to another dimension, and then, you know, you'll be in a dimension for one of the characters. So when the Dot Hack characters wound up in their dimension, basically nobody could get over the fact they were in a virtual world. But then when they left their dimension and went to Tokyo, they're like, wait, we actually live in Tokyo, but now we're digital avatars. What's going on? It's just the constant barrage of insanity the game's willing to throw at you, and just consistently keeps up this pace of here's something nuts that's about to happen. You know, here's a robot being piloted by an anthropomorphic rabbit from the Sakura Wars series. It's like, what? It's a robot rabbit, okay. And then afterwards you're fighting the shielders from you're fighting a shielder from Super Ghouls and Ghosts being protected by a bunch of met bots from Mega Man. It's like, well, yeah, this is some weird shit I'm dealing with right here. I mean, it's a good enough strategy game to be interesting, but it's really the characters of it that make it much more enjoyable. In the actual combat is somewhat of kind of a brawler strategy mix, because what's going on is you start with three attacks and potentially two support attacks. So it's just the A button, or then a directional on the control pad and the A button. And that picks your attack. And you can attack up to four times per turn. And if you do all the directions, you get another free attack. You can also summon this third character by pressing the L button, or you could summon another party who's nearby by pressing the R button. And the idea is that you want to chain your attacks in such a way that you build up your boost so you can release these special attacks, and you want to try to time them so the enemy doesn't get to reset their balance or doesn't get to put their shield back up. So you're sort of trying to juggle like you would in a brawler, but you're also basically calling on attacks like an RPG where you say, do this attack, and it goes off and it does a bunch of hits. You're trying to manage all these things sort of actively while you don't have full control over the battle. Mm. It's kind of a weird hybrid of a turn-based game and a Tails game. I mean, because like a Tails game, when you press A, he's not just going to attack once. He's going to attack like 48 times.
It just sounds though like if like once you get the timing down for the attacks, like the combat would stop being interesting. No,
to an extent, and then you swap characters, and the interaction with how they work with the supports changes it up a little bit.
Okay,
I mean it's really. You're going to chew through most of the drones, and then it's really a matter of trying to coordinate these attacks in such a way that you take out drones that are going to attack next, so you deny the enemy moves, or trying to mass your forces in such a way that you can challenge the big bosses, which will take many, many turns to wipe out. And really, it's all a big rush to get the fire off the super attack, which is like a 30-second animated sequence specific to those two characters that's just mental and stupid and amazing, and the dumbest thing you'll ever see, and yet the most brilliant thing in your life for you know, a minute. It's really insane stuff. Like there's two characters from what's the fighting game that for the Sega series? Virtua Fighter. It's the main character of Virtua Fighter plus Pi, and they basically take turns juggling the enemy back and forth on one of the square stages Virtual Fighter set on, and at the end of it, they ring out the character. They ring out the enemy.
That's ridiculous. And
they're just juggling them back and forth, and they're talking to each other the whole time. And these like hand animated close ups of their faces come up like right at the end for dramatic effect. It's really stupid and really amazing.
It ends in just a ring out.
Yeah, I mean, they just rings them out.
That's hilarious.
There's all this really insane stuff and these really well-crafted sequences for each pairing. And in battle, if you've got like two supports going and the main characters are just wailing away on the enemy, there's so much stuff going on screen. It's really kind of a lot to take in. And it's amazing the 3DS is just running this smoothly. I know it's just 2D sprites, but the whole screen is just chaos.
Hmm.
There's there's an attack that, you know, Tron does where she summons up all her support bots. I can't remember what they're called now.
They're called Koboons.
Yeah.
I know that because of Chris Kohler.
Nice. And she's riding on a giant one, just smashing them in the head with the mallet. And then you've got, like, I don't know, you've got two other characters just wailing away on them with special attacks. And your characters are blasting them with guns. And the game's just fine. It just carries on like a champ. It's really just the visual of just how stupid this is that keeps me going. And it's enjoyable enough on its own, but really just watching the game put on a show for you is where the joy comes in.
All right, guys. So I'm going to wrap up new business with a pair of games from our friends at Renegade Kid. I'll start off with the newest one, which is Mutant Muds Deluxe. This is the Wii U version of Mutant Muds, which came out about a year and a half ago on 3DS eShop. And I think you could easily argue that Mutant Muds was the first great eShop exclusive game. You know, at least a game that debuted on the 3DS eShop. And, you know, I've talked at length about it before. I think Mutant Muds is a very worthy successor to the Mega Man style of gameplay. It's a long game. It's very, very challenging. It has very simple mechanics, but it does a lot with them, and it really forces you to master those mechanics in a very low-key way. You know, it doesn't make a big deal out of it, but sometimes you'll look at a situation and you're like, I think the only way that you could possibly even do this is to like kind of hang, like hang 10 on the very last pixel on the edge of that ledge. And indeed, that is the only way to do it, you know? And so it's like, they don't put it in your face. It never feels like they're training you to play the game really well. It's just very natural. And it's just one of those things that kind of dawns on you very slowly at just how well these levels are designed, and also just how fucking crazy hard they are. And let me tell you, the good thing about Mutant Muds Deluxe, if you ever thought that Mutant Muds was too difficult, this is the game for you. And if you ever thought that it was not difficult enough, then this is the game for you. Because they've done a couple of interesting things with it. I mean, the majority of the game is certainly the same as what you've already played on 3DS or maybe on Steam, which is the other big platform that they've released it on. Well, I'm pretty sure it was Steam, wasn't it?
No, he can't get it on Steam.
It's just on PC.
Yeah, it keeps being rejected on Greenlight for some reason.
Yeah, that's weird. It's really weird.
Like I guess like PC gamers don't like pixels that big. I don't know.
All my pixels inches.
I don't get it. And honestly, I haven't played the PC version, and I would have thought that the game would lose a lot from the lack of 3D stereoscopic effect, because on the 3DS, that effect helps you discern the different layers of the level, because it's actually developed very much like a Virtual Boy game, like a lot like Wario Land on Virtual Boy, because you have three or four different layers of the level that go back into the screen. And as you go farther back, you know, you just have these jump pads that just send you backwards and forward. And as you go farther back, the sprites all get smaller, but they also, they have this kind of field of view effect. So they get a little bit blurrier.
It gets out of focus, basically.
Yeah. So that's basically the way they've handled it. I assume this is how they do it on PC. It is certainly the way they do it on Wii U, which is that they basically use a kind of blur effect on all the layers that are not currently active. So you can still see all the layers at the same time, and even though you don't have the 3D effect of the 3DS screen, the blur effect does help a lot in kind of giving you the visual cues that you need to identify which enemies are on the correct layer that you are. And you also, on top of that, have the difference in size. So if you're familiar with the enemies and the normal size of those sprites, then you can pretty quickly identify which layer they're on. And more importantly, just are they on the same layer as you? Because if they're not, you don't care most of the time. But anyway, it's a very simple 2D platformer, and again, the Wii U version is pretty much the same as what you've seen before. The two major things they've added, optional checkpoints, which work kind of like the ones in BitTrip Runner, at least in the sense that you can actually turn them off if you think that they make the game too easy, or if you're afraid that you'll use them even by accident, even though you don't want to. So if you want it to be a more pure experience, there's on the pause menu, there's an option to just turn off the checkpoints. I am very happy to have them, not least of which because I've already played a lot of this game, and I'm, you know, to some extent, I'm replaying it, and so I'm not really in the mood to be frustrated with it. I just am happy to just burn through these levels and just enjoy them without a whole lot of friction. So I love that they've added that. They're a big help, and of course, you have unlimited lives, so once you hit a checkpoint, you're gold, you know, and you can retry as many times as you want from that checkpoint. And it remembers all the little diamonds that you found before that. So it's very, very useful if you're trying to be a completionist and get 100% on the game. So the other major thing that they added for Mutant Muds Deluxe is these ghost levels. And these are currently exclusive to the Wii U version. These are not even in the PC version. And they are, you can access them right from the beginning of the game. And they are very similar to the other levels. They're all, although they're all brand new, and the main difference is that they're just harder. And part of the reason that they're harder is that all the enemies in these ghost levels are invincible. So they're all ghost enemies, and they're based on the same enemy design. So they're like the familiar, you know, there's the flying dudes, and there's the guy with the sword, and there's the guys that just go up and down. So it's all the same enemies you've seen before, but now they're ghosts, which means that your weapon doesn't work on them. And so it actually has a really nice kind of subtle effect on the way that you play the levels, because now you have to avoid the enemies. You can't just kill whatever gets in your way. So it changes the dynamic of the way you proceed through the levels quite a bit. And it definitely makes them harder. Now there is a new power up that is the ghost gun or whatever you want to call it that allows you to, temporarily defeat the ghost enemies, but it's rare. It's not even in every level. It's not very useful because you still have to shoot most of the enemies two or three times. And a lot of times by that point, they're already on top of you. So you have to be very careful about how you even use it to be effective. The other thing is, as soon as you get rid of one of these ghosts, about 3 seconds later, it reappears. So you have to be really fast. Like if there's an enemy in your way and you feel like the only way to get past it is to use that gun, you have to be fast.
And you lose the gun after a couple of seconds, right?
That's, well, it's not that. It has a limited number of shots. So you really can't use it just willy-nilly. You have to be very judicious with it. And also, if you hit a checkpoint and then you die, when you restart at the checkpoint, you won't even have the ghost gun anymore. But they've designed it so that, you know, by the time you reach that point, you don't actually require it to get to the end of the level. It might have been helpful. It might have made things a little bit easier. But it is always possible to beat the level without it. From the checkpoint onward. So, you know, the ghost gun is certainly, it's not like it's a lot of fun to use. It shoots exactly like your normal gun, except it's way shittier. But it does add kind of a neat little twist on it. And like I said, for the most part, the ghost levels are the same. They're just a lot harder. And the music is neat. They add this kind of warble to the music, you know, to make it sound a little spookier. And it's very clever. And it also, those levels, I think, especially work really well with the field of view effect because the ghost enemies are all partially transparent. They're translucent. And so that looks really nice on the screen. And, you know, it's a game I've mostly been playing it on the gamepad. Just when I've been in the computer, I'm watching something on my computer, like on Hulu, and I'm playing it at the same time. So it's really, really nice for that. It also looks good on the TV, surprisingly, for the pixel art. And I would recommend it. Certainly, if you have not played Mutant Muds yet, I mean, I absolutely would recommend that you play at least one version of it. If you already have the 3DS version and you played the crap out of it, I don't know that this is really worth the upgrade. I mean, it's like $10, so it's not super expensive. But like I said, it's mostly the same thing all over again. So just keep that in mind. But it is certainly a very, very good version of a fantastic game. So I'm glad that it exists, and I'm glad that I bought it. The other thing, I have less to say about this probably, and it's not nearly as good, but the other Renegade kit that I bought recently is ATV Wild Ride 3D. And this is a four-wheeler ATV racing game that Renegade Kid developed for Nintendo DS, 2DS. So they converted it to 3DS eShop. And in the process, they did upgrade the graphics a little bit. They cleaned up the textures a little bit. The shadows and the lighting are slightly better. But frankly, this still looks like a DS game. It might be a somewhat glorified DS game, but it certainly is not up to snuff with, you know, Mario Kart 7 or, you know, whatever other 3DS racing game you might want to put it up next to. But hey, it's really cheap. It's on the eShop. It does have internet play, which is quite admirable. And they are trying to host like weekly internet nights where, you know, people who own the game can go online and actually find people to play it with. So I'm all supportive of that. I think it's a neat idea to release this kind of forgotten, limboed DS game on the eShop and sort of upconvert it a little bit and make it very affordable for people. Unfortunately, it's just not that great of a racing game. You know, I don't know what these guys' history is with making other racing games. I don't know if this is their first one or maybe they had done some licensed stuff. I'm not real clear on the history of it, but it's certainly not bad. It's just really bland. It's just, there's not a whole lot to it. You can do tricks, whenever you jump off a ramp, which gives it kind of like an Excitebike feel or maybe like SSX. But the trick system is very, very simple. And you don't really get to use it that much because the different tracks, and on it, usually you would do three laps around the track. It'll only have like three ramps on it. So you get boost from doing a trick, but there's really not a whole lot of skill or strategy to it. It's just like, well, I'm just going to use the trick that I have time to do before I land. There's really not a whole lot to it. And between those ramps, so like all the time when you're just racing and you're not in the air doing a trick, the game's really boring because there's just nothing to it. Like there's no weapons, there's no combat. You can run into the other car, into the other ATVs, but it doesn't really do anything. And that's not likely to happen anyway because they tend to be so spread out. There's only four vehicles for a given race. And usually all you're concerned about is like just trying to pass the one that's in front of you. And you don't really have a whole lot of, stuff you can do to actually catch up with the guy in front of you, except just do another trick. And so effectively what it feels like is that you end up just kind of trying not to make a mistake and just waiting for half a lap until you hit the next ramp. Cause then you can earn enough boost that you might actually be able to make a move on the other guy. But it feels like a lot of the game is just kind of racing around these tracks in this very, very simple racing physics engine. And just waiting for the next chance that you might actually get to do something strategic.
I was gonna say that was my vibe playing it at PAX. It just didn't seem.
Yeah.
I think I might have turned to you and just noted it didn't seem interesting.
It's not very interesting. It's not very deep.
No.
It's missing. I feel like there's at least one or two mechanics here that are missing. Mm. I mean, there's really not much to it. It's well done. It's executed well, but it's such a forgettable racing game. So anyway, that's it for new business. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First this week, we have a staff says on summer games. The NWS staff breaks down their plans for the gaming doldrums of summer, and it turns out we're not much better than the rest of you. Eh.
I'm going to play that GameCube volleyball game from Tecmo. Namco.
Beach Strikers?
Yeah!
Beach Spikers, is it?
That's my summer game jam.
I don't know. I know it was competing against DOAX, so...
good lord.
Nothing can compete with that.
We also have a review of Shin Megami Tensei 4 for the 3DS by Justin Baker. I've retired from the samurai demon husbandry industry. The game's changed and I'm too old and broken to keep at it. If you're new, well maybe there's something there for you in Shin Megami Tensei 4. Turns out it's got some teeth.
Next up, we have a preview for Pokemon X and Y on 3DS by Alex Kalafi. I've retired from the preteen animal husbandry industry. Pokemon has changed, and I've been too old and broken to keep at it. Seriously, though, X and Y looks like it has some nice tweaks to the well-worn franchise of upscaled beetle fighting. Alex has a rundown of new content in Nintendo's Cash Milk Tank. There is also a feature called Our Top 5 Games of 2013 So Far. How early can you put out a Best Games of the Year list? Turns out the answer is July 2. Our staff likes some games. They like some a lot. But we're not giving out awards yet because we're not that crazy.
Actually, we are that crazy. We have a feature, NWR E3 2013 Awards. NWR handed out awards already, but these are for games that aren't out yet. NWR celebrates the best things we saw at last month's Electronic Entertainment Expo, E-Cubed. And we have a review of Kokuga on the 3DS by James Dawson. The tank shooter from the director of Ikaruga is much loved by James, who loves the bus variety and streamlined gameplay. Ignore what John just said and go read this instead. You know who to trust and who not to.
Oh, do you ever. Alright, we have a review of Star Wars Pinball by Curtis Bonds. I've retired from the Star Wars pinball industry. The game has changed and I've been too old and broken to keep at it. Star Wars is easy, seriously. Throw a few bucks around and she'll do anything. This time, it's about the balls. Pinball. It's pinball. It's good. Alright, we have impressions of Jisha to Chibi Robo for 3DS by Danny Bivens. The tiny robot is back, and this time he's tasked with collecting Nostal junk for a museum exhibit. Platforming and exploration return with some AR functionality for the 3DS camera.
I'm so glad that Chibi Robo is still a thing. So definitely go read about that and check out all of these original articles over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Yo. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for your listener mail. These people all sent their questions and ideas to rfn at nintendoworldreport.com, and Guillaume is going to read the first one this week.
Yep. D-Copman writes, upon the announcement that ZubbyU was not profitable, quote-unquote, not even close, do you think Ubisoft may be pulling the plug on third-party support soon, especially if the Wii U has a lackluster Christmas sale total with impending competition from PS4 and Xbox One?
Well, first off, I want to say it is very hard for your game to be profitable when you sell it at launch to a limited audience and also when you develop it twice before release.
Yeah, that doesn't help things.
That makes it very, very hard to sell enough units to make it profitable, even if it is a big hit. And ZombiU, relative to the audience, was a pretty big hit. It sold to a significant fraction of the people who own a Wii U system, but...
It did.
But, it's hard to imagine a game that had been in development for, what, 3 or 4 years and had been pretty much restarted at some point right in the middle of it and is exclusive to that platform. You know, certainly they probably thought Wii U would be more successful than it has been.
But it's a risk either way, however you cut it.
It was restarted and then it was Rush Job developed too.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I guarantee you they spent a lot more on that game than they would have otherwise if they didn't have to develop it in a year from scratch.
Yeah, I mean they had a lot of it. They had a lot of the backbone back when it was, what was it, like Killer Mutants from Outer Space?
It was Killer Freaks from Outer Space.
Yeah. So I mean, they, in a lot of ways, they certainly had the engine down, and they had some of the art style. But it was pretty shocking at E3, last year to find out, oh wow, they turned that into this really rather serious zombie game. I don't think any of us here on the show played a lot of Zombie U, but certainly the people who do seem to love it. I don't think it's quite up my alley, frankly, based on what I've played, but I certainly respect it, and I'm glad that it exists, but, I think if the game is not profitable, it's Ubisoft's fault, really. I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but maybe don't spend $50 million developing a launch title. You fucking crackhead.
I still kind of wonder if Killer Freaks would have been better suited towards the audience that was available at the Wii U launch.
That's almost certain.
It had a much more sense of humor about itself.
I probably would have bought it.
Yeah, ZombiU is just... strikingly humorless.
I was a lot more excited about that game than I was about Zombie U.
I mean, that's the thing. It sold about, I think, I'm just looking online here, it sold about 460,000 copies. So it's not like it sold 50,000 copies. You know? That's a sizable number.
It had not great sales, obviously, but it was...
But considering the Wii U's user base, I mean... It was the Wii U's still at, I mean, maybe 4 million.
Yeah, I mean, that's an M-rated launch title on a Nintendo platform. I mean, it did pretty fucking good.
Yeah. I mean, that's selling to like a quarter of the, that's
a tenth.
Not a quarter, but a tenth of the user base, yeah.
You have to wonder what their expectations were, because I remember the I mean, the advertising campaign for it. Like, I actually saw ads for the game.
Yeah, I know.
Before movies and before, like, it seemed to be a big deal for them.
Maybe that was the problem. Maybe they spent a lot of money on marketing.
Right. That might not have been the most efficient use of their marketing budget.
Yeah.
We call that the Lone Ranger paradigm.
You know, I do think with Zombie U, it's probably the kind of game that will become profitable eventually as they reduce the price, you know, they throw it on eShop. And as Wii U, as the user base increases over the next year or two, because Nintendo has to fix their shit, obviously, it's a game that, because it is a distinctive, exclusive title that had very good critical response, very good word of mouth, it is a game that people will go back and want to find a copy of. And if they make new copies of it, especially digital copies, affordable, then it's a game that I think it's very easy to sell Zombie U to a person who buys Wii U in November 2013. You know, and they may not make as much money on it as they would have a year earlier, but they'll continue to make money on it. I think eventually it'll do okay. But am I surprised that they're not making a sequel to it? Not really. I don't think they should have made a sequel to Red Steel, but that didn't stop Ubisoft because they're not very smart.
I think it's sort of a brand management thing. You have to understand what the brand, what values your brand brings to the table. And if it doesn't bring tangible value, then you need to make a decision on whether or not you want to perpetuate it.
It's funny how some publishers seem to discover what people actually think of their game when they release the sequel. Because it's not like, like they'll sell a game and it's hugely popular. It sells a lot of copies, but you know, no one likes it, and then like that, it's only reflected in the sales of the sequel. Even if it could, yeah. Like, even if it's better in every aspect, it's not really representative of the quality of the sequel. It's really a reflection of what people thought of the original.
And also, what's happening in the market at the time? Are there other games competing against it? Is it a launch title? Are people just buying it because it's the only thing out there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or are people sick of zombie games? Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. But
The Last of Us just sold 3.4 million.
Hey, those aren't zombies.
They're look zombies.
They're fungal.
There's medicine behind that, buddy. Medicine.
Yeah, it's real science, man. You saw the chapter art last week, didn't you? I worked hard to find that. You know, I don't really see this as being a huge problem, not least of which because Ubisoft typically, and you see this over and over and over again, they throw most of their support behind a console at launch anyway, and we're already pretty much through that period. Certainly with this holiday season, we'll have really kind of closed the loop on the early days of Wii U, and Ubisoft, you know, that's kind of when they're guaranteed to support a system anyway, and after that, well, it's all up in the air. It all depends, right? So I don't really think the situation with Wii U is any different than it is for anything else. I think, and I don't think the situation with Ubisoft is that much different than it is for other third parties. I think third party support for Wii U is bad across the board, and it's certain. I mean, I think Ubisoft would be crazy to kind of totally get behind Wii U and say, well, we love this platform. We think it's going to be a huge success. I mean, you couldn't say that with a straight face, right? So they should be cautious. They should say, like, well, we're still releasing our games for now, but we need to see results. We need to see that they actually sell. We need to see that Nintendo sells more systems so there's more potential customers. I mean, that's just good business. So I think this guy is saying what he needs to say, and I can hardly be surprised about it. Do I think they're going to pull the plug on support? Not really, but they may end up in an Activision situation where they really only release like one or two games a year that are, you know, more likely to be profitable, like something like Call of Duty, where they can just kind of do a port of an existing version and say, you know, look, we got our token support and, you know, it did well enough, but we're not going to do any exclusive games for it. But I mean, Ubisoft, I mean, the loss of Ubisoft exclusive support on Wii U was over back in February when Rayman Legends didn't come out, you know, so this is not a huge new development, I don't think.
Well, you know, like they still got their multi-console games coming for now. We're going to get Splinter Cell apparently the same time as the other consoles, so that's some sort of positive.
Yeah, I think the question comes down to, are they going to do anything for it? Is it just going to be a straight-up port of the 360 version?
isn't it a cross-platform game? Like, I mean, like, it's not a port of an old game this time.
No, it's not. But I mean, like, are they gonna do anything with the gamepad? Are they gonna do anything with the graphics? Are they just gonna say, here's 360 version?
Well, with the way that they're not really showing it, I suppose that we know the answer.
Here's the 360 version. Suck it down.
Yeah.
Thanks, Duke.
All right, so John is gonna read the next email.
All right, Daryl, aka Fenrir _ VII writes. A big game media trend in Wii U reviews and the quote-unquote the future of Wii discussions is the topic of the gamepad and how most games aren't using it in new and exciting ways. I've also seen third-party developers cite having no new ideas for the gamepad as a reason to not develop for Wii U. As a big fan of both the Wii U Pro Controller and off-TV play, I usually feel that these discussions are bashing the system or games for something that it really isn't a major problem. I appreciate using the gamepad to streamline menu and map options, and at the same time, I am less likely to buy a game that does not feature off-TV play. So my question is this. Do you feel it is fair to discredit the system and or games for not using the gamepad in new and interesting ways when, quote-unquote, small improvements like off-TV play and menu map control can make a big difference in how convenient it is to play games? Also, would you discredit a game that was designed solely for the Wii U Pro Controller, such as a standard port from PS3 or Xbox 360?
This is a great question.
The gamepad is a Wii U Pro Controller. It just has a screen on it. So yeah, I don't... Like, it's already a controller. Like, that excuse has always been bullshit, in my opinion. Like, they're not developing for a Wii U, but I don't think it's because, like, we haven't found this great idea. They don't need one. It's not really attractive to port their game to Wii U.
If a developer had a great idea for the gamepad, I don't think they would be opposed to going down that route and trying it out. With that being said, I haven't seen a great idea for the gamepad. And I know his point is that, off-TV play is a great idea. Off-TV play is great. But Nintendo sold us the gamepad. And they talked about how you'd be able to do all these things, but they've never told us what these things are. And I think I don't want to say they owe it to their fans, but they should at least be attempting to show us, hey, here's something you can't do with another controller. Here's something that you have to have the two screens to work out right. And while off-TV play is one of those things, it's not really a game changer in terms of what the game is like. It's just a different mechanism for looking at the game.
Off-TV play was kind of one of the selling points of the console.
If you're someone
who doesn't have the TV all the time for yourself, like, this is potentially one of the reasons why you got a Wii U. And it is potentially the reason why you would get the Wii U version of a game if it came out on multiple consoles.
And like I said, that's fine, but there should by now, there should definitively be games that do stuff with the gamepad that can't be done otherwise.
Yeah, well, the problem is, too, though, the Wii install base isn't big enough to really attract anybody that's going to experiment with that.
Well, I don't agree with that statement. I think there are smaller developers who should, or Nintendo. Nintendo should be experimenting with that.
Yeah, I mean, you can't excuse Nintendo. You know?
Yeah, I think there are independent publishers and developers who would be more than willing to try something out if they thought they had a good idea. I think Ubisoft was pushing ground with Rayman, but ultimately, I mean, it's still the best implementation of the gamepad and a platformer I've played to date. Mm-hmm. And that's a third party game, and ultimately Nintendo had time to crib for New Super Mario Brothers and didn't. I mean, they left in the dumb touch to create panels, but I haven't seen anything that makes me say, that's really truly a unique idea, and it bothers me a little bit because I like off-screen play. It's actually something that I use with some regularity, but I would like to have new experiences that this gamepad presents. I mean, this is part of the reason the system is what it is. If Nintendo didn't create the gamepad, they would have focused the system somewhere else, and maybe they would have come up with the more successful format. But they certainly haven't mined a lot of success out of this one.
Well, it's always interesting because, you know, in the past Nintendo has typically said that they've created a controller to match a game idea that they've had, like as the story goes.
Like, did you see the Nintendo of America tweet from this week where they're quoting some interview with Miyamoto where he said, "I feel like Wii U is really designed for Pikmin 3," and I was like, "So then why wasn't that game ready for launch?"
Yeah, exactly.
Or what? Not even that. Why did you launch the system without it if that's the game that the system was?
Because they needed the system first before they could make the game. Come on, get it together.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, as the story goes, you know, the Nintendo 64 controller was for Super Mario 64 specifically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this just does not seem to be the case this time around.
And you know what? I'm cool with that. I don't think you should design a system around a single game. I think that's kind of dumb. I don't think it did the N64 a whole lot of favors either. I just feel you should have a clear idea of the kinds of things you would like to do.
Yeah.
And if you look at Nintendo Land, the kinds of things they would like to do with this controller and this system are just not very deep experiences, you know?
No,
and that's what concerns me. It's like, you know, I'm fine with there being a kind of tech demo-y package in the beginning to kind of express some of the concepts that they have, but I don't think they've really done a whole lot to show us the next level of what you can do with all that stuff. You know, even Pikmin 3, the stuff they're doing with the gamepad has nothing to do with what they showed in Nintendo Land.
And, you know, we saw this with the Wii Remote Plus. I mean, there were ideas in Wii Sports Resort that ultimately only really came to fruition in Zelda.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's what we've, you know, referred to Wii Sports Resort as Skyward Sword, like beta test.
Yeah.
And that's really what it ended up feeling like. I mean, I never played a game besides Skyward Sword that made any meaningful use of the Remote Plus. And that's kind of nuts.
I guess one of the problems is that the gamepad and a TV for a single player together don't really offer anything all that new. Like, basically, it's a giant DS. If you were to try to make, like, some sort of new experience, it would have, I think, to be necessarily a two-player game. Like, someone else on the TV would be doing something else than the person on the gamepad.
I don't know if that's true, though, because from a hardware standpoint, the Wii U is capable of stuff that the DS and 3DS were never capable of. So I think you can have evolutions of ideas that just didn't work because of screen size limitations or hardware power limitations. That would work on the DS.
I mean, the secondary screen on Wii U is separate, so it's not tied in by a hinge to the top screen. And that gives you a lot more flexibility in how those two screens interact with each other. You know, and you've seen ideas like Shield Pose, and you've seen some things like that kind of hint at maybe what
the
you
ability,
can do.
Yeah, I mean, Shield Pose is great because it blends sort of kind of AR stuff with the system.
Yeah, but that concept is hardly selling you, James, on a copy of Game & Wario.
Not yet, but it will. It's the only thing I want in Game & Wario. But but you could, I mean, you could, that's an idea that you actually could build around.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's what Nintendo needs. They need ideas that can say, look, you can build a concept around this. You can make something. You can go somewhere with this idea. I mean, they've done that a couple times. They did that with the virtual tour things.
You're seeing stuff done with like smart glass that you aren't even seeing done with the gamepad.
Like,
you know, where you can call in airstrikes in Dead Rising 3 or whatever.
That's just a button.
It's just, yeah, but I mean,
you're just a button.
Why isn't a game coming out with that kind of stuff in it? But I mean, also for Assassin's Creed 4. You know, they have like maps that play along. You know,
and that stuff.
But the gamepad is doing that.
Yeah. Though. That stuff is on the gamepad. It's just that
I'm not sure I'm buying the idea that smart glass is doing something that the gamepad isn't or can't.
I'm not sitting here like really propping up smart glass, but I'm just saying like maybe basically that stuff isn't really even being talked about much on gamepad if it is there.
No, I agree, but also if you look at the kind of, you know, the thing is no one's really that excited about smart glass.
No.
And I think when you look at the sort of thud of reaction to smart glass, it tells you a lot about why the Wii U is doing like it is. It's because people don't necessarily care about separating those experiences into multiple devices. you know, and having a secondary screen. And I certainly think there's the potential to have something really, really compelling and fascinating and new that people really want to get into. I just don't think Nintendo's shown it yet. And if they're not going to show it, who is? That's kind of my problem is like, guys, I think there's a lot to be done with this controller, but you know, you just showed us the first 18 months of software that you've had planned for this platform. And I don't really see it beyond that one launch title, or maybe two if you include Zombie U. Like that's about the extent of the innovative use of this gamepad that I've seen.
To the point of understanding, you know, how you could use the gamepad, it doesn't really even need to be that revolutionary. I mean, you have in the gamepad a controller that's infinitely capable of reconfiguring itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. think about a game that attempted to do that just recently and failed miserably in Steel Battalion Heavy Armor. It tried to give you infinite reconfiguring controls through the Kinect interface. Well, you could do that on the gamepad. The controls
are
all
overlays.
Right.
Think of the overlays and like what was it, the ColecoVision or the no the
what?
The Intellivision and the ColecoVision had overlays.
Actually, I was going to bring up that mech game, that Japanese DS game that Greg talked about a couple years ago,
oh.
where all the mech controls are on the DS touchscreen. Wouldn't
yes.
that be cool if they did a version of that for Wii U?
Oh yeah, or I mean, you could do that for oh my god, my favorite Sega space combat RPG. I'm blanking on the name now.
Oh.
Infinite Space.
Infinite
yes.
Space. Yeah.
I mean, that's
yes.
what Infinite Space did. All the controls were on the bottom screen. You could do a ton with stuff like that. Nintendo should just go buy that IP and say, we're going to make this game now.
Even the stuff, I mean, the like really cliched use of the gamepad screen is to just throw a map on there. I don't feel like there are really any games out for Wii U where that's even a useful feature. I mean, there certainly are games like Darksiders 2, for instance, that do put a map on the screen. That's mm-hmm. not a game where you would probably use the map that much.
And its implementation of the map sucked.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think even that, I mean, I don't want to discount the fact that you could put a map on the gamepad screen. That could be extremely fucking useful in a lot of games, but
yep.
those games aren't on Wii U. That's my
yeah.
problem, you know? It's yeah. like... There's a mismatch here of what the console can do and what it is doing. And it's totally solvable. But I don't really see that on the horizon. I don't really see any signs that Nintendo or third parties are moving in the direction where they're really going to utilize the system that they've already released. It's like, I don't really want to spend a lot of time wondering what Nintendo might have done if they had just gone with a normal controller and put all that development cost into a more powerful console, because this is the system that we do have, and we're going to have it for at least 4 or 5 years. I just really want them to use what they have better. And
right.
to tell that story better so that more people buy it, so that we get more good games for it. And that's why I'm frustrated.
And you've basically already bought out Platinum Games. Just go ahead and pay them to make another Infinite Space. Just do it. The Wii U, right
yeah,
now. You have
yeah, because that's the solution to their
that's
market
That's the solution
problems,
to all the
James.
Problems. A game that sold like 40,000 copies in Japan. That's the solution.
That's the one that'll push me over, James.
You're right.
It
right.
should. It's an awesome game. It's as evidenced by my experience at PAX. Fuck this game!
It might even sell as many copies as Project X Zone. But James,
it'll sell
actually,
less than that.
James, why don't you read the next email?
Stefan writes, "Hello. Well, it's time to bitch about something Nintendo-related. The object of my bitching today is Atlas and their upcoming Shin Megami Tensei 4, or whatever the fuck it's called. The game looks great, however, they've gone on the record stating that it will retail at $50. This is the price of the physical copy, which includes some throwaway trinkets and such. Lucky us, the digital version will also be $50, with none of the above perks. I want to harken back to when Capcom implied that Resident Evil Revelations would be $50, and the internet exploded with outrage. I have heard not an ounce of discontent, and I want to know if you think this is because they are considered a, quote, underdog company by fans. I think charging $50 for the game is shameful in the physical form, with no option for a $40 SKU without the collector's item crap. I think charging $50 for the digital version is a total slap in the face and has made me want to skip it altogether. Bear in mind that the first party has charged $35 for Animal Crossing, Donkey Kong, and Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. Thanks, guys. First off, $35 for Pokemon Mystery Dungeon means you are getting raped. It is awful.
There's a lot of different things here. I don't think that Atlus is being considered an underdog company by fans. I think it's a company that knows its fans and that has kind of cultivated this kind of, well, their fandom. And they know that they can sell a game for $50, even if it's portable. You know, like they know that they've got their fans who will support them
at
that
price. And Atlus games, by and large, end up selling at a premium anyway. I mean, Atlus DS games were always on the high side price. And I'm not saying the $50 price is justifiable, but I mean...
Well, the thing is, you can rationalize it to yourself because of all the stuff they're throwing in there. And they know that their fans actually want all those bonus goods that they're throwing into the physical copy. And that, you know, that this price is not only swallowable to those people, but they'll feel that they got a good deal out of it. So I certainly don't think that they're... you know, that they're taking advantage of their fans. I think, well, this is a big game. It was expensive to make. And look at all this cool stuff that we're throwing in. Don't you think this is worth $50? And I'll tell you right now, the first run of this game will sell out. So, there are enough people who do think it's worth $50. No problem. And I'm also cool with it because if this game is successful, and I think it will be based on the reviews and everything else I've heard about it, especially this deal that Nintendo just announced, the eShop credit and everything, I think this is going to be a modest success, and I think they're going to sell out the first run, and they're going to make a second run, and they have an opportunity at that point to do a cheaper version that doesn't have all that stuff packed in, the same way XSEED did with the last story in Pandora's Tower. So as a person who would totally like to get this game but might not want to spend $50 on it, I'm very happy with this situation. But I do take extreme issue with the fact that the eShop version is also $50, because obviously you don't get all that bonus stuff with the digital.
That's
version.
Not Atlus is doing though. No. Nintendo established that precedent.
Precedent aside, are you saying that Atlus does not have the ability to control the price of their game on the eShop? Because I think they do.
No, I think they could, but I think Atlus looks at the rest of the market and says, well, nobody else is fucking doing it. I think. If you want to see prices of eShop versions come down, Nintendo's the company you need to pressure. Because everybody's going to play Follow the Leader with them on their platform. And to be honest, that's kind of... If I was doing them and Nintendo wasn't dropping price on digital copies, I sure as hell wouldn't. You kidding?
Yeah, but Nintendo doesn't drop the price on anything. I mean, if all the third parties are looking to Nintendo as the example for how to do pricing on their games, then we would never get a price drop on anything.
Well, because they're not all as successful at marketing their shit as Nintendo is.
Right.
I mean, I understand why they did it. I don't think it's a good proposition, and that's why I don't buy digital 3DS games.
Well, I
because
certainly
the
won't
value,
buy
the
this
value
game
proposition
digitally.
Is not there. And, I mean, you know, we can complain about it here, but I think it's just as legitimate complaint for any other game that comes out. I don't think this game is particularly more of a egregious sin than any other, because ultimately when you buy a digital copy, you still don't have, you know, the infinite redistribution of your copy. It's still not a physical thing you own. It's still something that if Nintendo's eShop were to go down one day, you would not be able to re-download. I mean, it's the ultimate proposition here is still you own it less than you would if you owned a physical version. So I think ultimately that's what the biggest value differential is, and that's why I don't buy digital copies. The only reason I bought digital Fire Emblem was because that's the only way you could get the damn game.
Yeah, like, and also that might be the case for this game as well. Keep in mind, I mean, if this game is as scarce as many Atlus games are post-launch, then having it digitally is a big boon for people who hear about it from word of mouth a month later, and then find out that they can no longer find the physical copy.
Atlus does not make big runs of their game, and in fact, the best case for discussing that is their DS RPG. What was it called?
Radiant Historia.
Yeah, Radiant Historia, where the only reason I got a copy was I reviewed it, because they, like, I never saw a copy on sale ever.
Oh, but they reprinted it eventually.
They did. They reprinted it, like, twice. They reprinted it, like, a year later. And you know what happened to that reprint?
Okay. But you can buy it right now. Like, you can go buy for $20, like, Shin Megami Tensei 3 Nocturne on PS2 for $20 new on Amazon. Like, they do reprints when they can.
They do,
when it's worth it for them.
But it takes a long time for them to do them for some reason. I don't know what it is. I don't know what's up with that company. It may just be a resource thing. I mean, they don't have a lot of money, as we know. Mm. But, I mean, it took, like I said, it took them almost a year to do a reprint for Radiant Historia. I mean, it took...
I think in the letter, there's like an assumption that the trinkets that they give out with the retail copy are what are driving the price up to $50. And I don't think that's true at all. Like, that CD costs them nothing. The booklet is probably, like, probably looks good, but probably doesn't cost them very much to produce either.
Well, it's not necessarily the manufacturing or even the shipping cost to include that stuff. It costs money to put that stuff together. It costs money to license those songs and to get the CD printed.
Well, it's their music. They don't have to pay any money to license it. It's their music.
Yeah. It's like the score of the game.
I think ultimately the goodies that come with Atlas Games and some other companies do it. Project Crosszone did it. Mm-hmm. I think it's really just a reward for the most hardcore fans that want these physical copies.
Where's the reward for those of us who aren't that hardcore and just want to play the game?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you would be very happy to buy it digitally and reward Atlas for putting the game on the eShop with increased profitability because they don't have to pay some fucking
retailer. Well, then you should be more hardcore
to stock the game.
Buy the physical copy then.
Well, I'm probably going to be just because there's so little incentive in this case. I mean, there is a convenience factor in that the game would exist on my system and I wouldn't have to keep up with the cartridge. But at $50, you know, especially when the physical copy does come with all this cool stuff that I might actually use one day. As a guy who buys, I buy virtually all my 3DS games digitally. And I have been for a few months now since, Paper Mario came out, I guess was probably the first time. I would not recommend that anyone buy Shin Megami Tensei 4 on the eShop, not at $50, cause you're getting a really raw deal. And I think that sucks. And I hope that they fix that soon after launch. And the thing is, like, once the game is sold out at retail, who's going to care if they discount the digital version at that point? Like, they can't really undercut retailers who aren't stocking the game anymore.
Right. Well, the price can come down eventually. Right now, there's a $10 discount on Soul Hackers.
Sure.
So, and that's only, what, like 3 or 4 months after release?
From Atlas, but I mean, that happens with retail copies as well. From Atlas's perspective, there's probably no reason to drop the price significantly right now, especially with Nintendo giving them the boost of this $30 credit.
Yeah.
I mean, for them, this is probably going to be the best sales they could hope for, more so because of Nintendo linking it to the successful Fire Emblem boat.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is when the game is hottest, right? I mean, that's when it's getting the most buzz, yeah. And, you know.
I don't, like, personally, I'm not attracted to trinkets at all. Like, I just moved. And
yeah, that will kill it. That will kill it. That's
but you know what?
For me.
I just moved, and I actually enjoyed going through my games.
Okay.
I enjoyed when I'd pick one up and go, you know, I want to replay this.
Yeah, the only ones that I buy any trinkety stuff. I don't really get trinkety stuff, but
because John lost a cat because it couldn't eat after it got the Halo hat put on.
No, it's like the only stuff I go for now is in-game stuff. If there's cool in-game stuff, or like I'll get a. Like with Halo 4, where it's like if you bought the CE or whatever, you get the pass for all the DLC. Same thing with
Black Ops,
Call of Duty stuff. Like, that stuff to me makes sense. Like, I'll lay that extra money out.
I just know that I'm never going to listen to that music CD, and I'm never going to look at that art booklet.
They get the...
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, I mean, I actually, you know, if I get... I've got a few Atlas games... like 6 DS Atlas games, and they all had the little CDs, they had the little art books. I'll usually run through the CD once or so. It's not like you can't get all this music online 30 seconds after the game comes out.
Mm-hmm.
It's all out there. I mean, I don't think the trinkets are really... I don't think Atlas views putting the trinkets in the box as a significant increase to the value proposition of the game. Mm-hmm. I think it's something they do to differentiate themselves more than anything else.
Well, yeah, it's fan service. I mean,
they know that their fans. I mean, they've cultivated one of probably the most hardcore fan bases out there. And it's small, it's loud, and it's an incredibly niche group. But it's something they do continually for them because it's part of cultivating that relationship. The argument of, well, then what do you do for the people who buy the game digitally? The question is, you know, it's something that ultimately needs to be answered more broadly by the industry. I mean, if Nintendo decided to expand the rewards program to the 3DS, then yeah, you could say, well, that's what you're getting. You're getting the reward points on it. Mm-hmm. But they haven't done that. I think ultimately it's a platform level issue more than it is individually
but
for Atlas.
Is it still like the kind of the fear of getting abandoned by the retailers? Because yes. This game has a ton of retailer exclusive DLC. Like you can, your pre-order code for ordering from Amazon is that you get a samurai vest that looks like an Amazon box.
They can't abandon retail fast enough. I hate that stuff.
What Johnny just mentioned is that John does it buys games exactly for that kind of bullshit.
I love it. I totally do.
You know what, though? I like the idea of the Amazon box-themed samurai vest.
It's pretty awesome.
It's just so far into the stupid category
and
that
you know,
I kind of
like,
want
I,
it.
I think that GameSpot has the same kind of thing where they've got their logo or whatever on the samurai vest.
You know, that kind of stuff, it's stupid and it's groan-worthy. But at the same time, I kind of appreciate that they did it because it's kind of funny.
Well, and
I think it doesn't yield any kind of bonuses for your character.
No, I think
like,
they're
not,
in
yeah.
on the joke. I mean, they know it's a joke. It's just sort of a fun thing to do.
Yeah, but I was bringing it up just because you know I think that they do depend a lot on Amazon and other retailers. Like I'm sure they would want to get all their sales from digital sales, but at the same time, like there's so many people who will just not buy on eShop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just saying, can't they cater to both?
Nope.
It would be nice, but
yeah,
probably
I
not.
I think they can.
I bet they can't. Really I bet the retailers would have a shit fit if they tried to cater to both.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think so. But
well, I mean, honestly, Johnny, there's no
retailers
evidence.
Retailers are middlemen.
Johnny, there's basically no evidence to prove you're right now because no one's trying it. And I think the fact that nobody's trying it is pretty telling. I think
well, we'll see. I mean, Nintendo is now releasing all of their first party games digitally on the same day. So
at the same price,
and that's how I'm buying them because fuck retailers.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so, they're releasing them the same day at same price.
At the same price, that's right. But on Wii U, I get 10% back, cash back essentially, not cash, but eShop credit back.
Right.
And, you know, on PS3, if you have PlayStation Plus and you buy something, you know, like the first week, you get 10% off. So there are encroachments into the retail stranglehold on this stuff. And
by
I'm
the
very
platform
happy
holders.
To see it, and I want to see more and more and more of it. And I'm always happy for retail and for physical copies to be an option for people. I just want the digital option to be more as lucrative to the consumer as it is to the publisher.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I just want some parity.
And this deal that you get $30 eShop credit for buying you know, Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei 4 is definitely a step in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Is it though?
But it's I mean and you know, I think it's to their credit that deal applies whether you buy those games physically or digitally.
Yeah, but you're only going to be able to buy a digital game with it.
That's right. Yeah. The reward is purely digital. So you're right. I think it is sort of promoting the digital future that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Maybe come back in a couple years and see how things have changed. Anyway, I'm going to read the next email. So Mike from Perth, Australia writes, if I was a WADA, I would use this holiday season to relaunch the Wii U. With a full year of games under its belt, it could easily still compete with, if not better, the sales of the latest gen of competitor consoles. With the focus slowly moving away from the gamepad, I would release a lower-priced Wii U without the gamepad and instead include a controller pro. Throw in a couple of bundles like Mario 3D World or DKC Tropical Freeze, and I think they would capture a good majority of the casual gaming market. Hey, and even still a few hardcore gamers away from PS4 and Xbox. Add a heavily Western-focused marketing campaign the promise of great titles for 2014, and I think they could get themselves back on track. What are your thoughts?
They'll never get rid of the gamepad because it would make them look like absolute fools.
And they would be fools.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. But the reason I wanted to read this letter from Mike is that I thought the idea of relaunching Wii U is fascinating. And we can have the debate on how would you do that. And Mike's suggestion is we'll just release a different version that doesn't have the gamepad and you can kind of appeal to a different segment of the market. But I wanted to hear, you know, all of our thoughts on maybe if you wanted to relaunch the Wii U, how would you kind of couch that?
It's kind of tough with the game lineup they have coming up.
Time Machine?
Yeah.
yeah, they would have to go back a couple of months, if not a couple of years, and just convince developers to give support. Like they just
convince themselves to have games ready.
Yeah.
I mean,
like,
that's...
actually have Ken Levine bring a game to the Wii U instead of saying, like, hey, Wii U's great.
Well, the nice thing about the concept of relaunching is that you can sort of pretend that everything before that didn't exist, didn't happen.
But it did.
Because for the people who haven't yet bought a system, basically it didn't happen, right? Mm. You've got all these games that are now, you've got a whole year of games. Now, it's not a very dense year of game releases.
Yeah, you've got like 3 months worth of games.
That they can fall back on. But they have a number of things, including some very good launch titles, that they can go back and say, well, look, you haven't played this game yet. It's not brand new, but it's new to you. And we, you know, there's new stuff coming out that you're going to be excited about. And we've done something with the hardware to make it more appealing to you, you know.
Hell,
and
they've made something with, like, they actually made the OS more complete. It wasn't finished when they actually launched a Wii U. I think that's a big deal.
It is, although the way that they've optimized it is, although very nice for those of us who use the system frequently, the fact that it's faster and it's going to get even faster, that's really hard to advertise.
Yeah, and
you know,
quantify
to
people. I mean, I think something that we've talked about on here, I mean, if you really want to relaunch this thing, have something to do, improve the VC lineup, improve that, make it more of a service than just what you have now.
And also just highlight it.
Yes.
Just like, let people know that Virtual Console is a thing that exists.
Yeah.
Because I think people will be interested.
So you don't think they did that with the 30 cents promotion?
They did it to people who already own the system.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think Nintendo, I think a lot of what they're doing right now preaches just to the choir.
Yeah.
To people that are already converted. A lot of the stuff that they're doing is, you know, I mean, really, I mean, the, you know, Fire Emblem deal, that's great, but mostly those games are going to be bought by Nintendo fans.
Already. Yeah, I'm happier with my Wii U every day. And a system update came out even as we've recorded this podcast that allows it to update further system updates even when the system is powered off and it's kind of in standby mode.
See,
and that's great.
It's pretty sweet.
But if I don't already have a Wii U, I don't care.
See, to me though, I'm like it's a matter of just having stuff to play. My Wii U is a Netflix box right now.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they could relaunch it.
They
next
need to
Christmas.
Relaunch the Wii U to me. I'm serious.
Yeah,
I mean, to me, it's the Netflix box. It's the Netflix screen that I can take with me when I go into the kitchen.
Yep.
But I mean, the point remains: they need to relaunch it to people who already own the system.
Yep.
Yeah.
They
yeah,
need
there,
to get.
There's something to be said for that, and even then, there are games that have come out on it, James, that you might be interested in, but they haven't made the case to you that you should buy it. And if you bought it, you might be playing it more.
Well,
often.
That's why they need to relaunch it. They need to get me involved in the ecosystem again. Because, I mean, I only follow it as much as my role in the site demands I do.
Yeah, you're not excited about
right.
it. Yeah. I'll tell you the thing. If I was Iwata, the way I would relaunch the Wii U, unfortunately, is not realistic this year. But maybe sometime in 2014, I would relaunch the box with a new and improved gamepad. Something that is a little sexier, a little easier to show off in advertisements, and is something that people feel like they're not getting a crappy tablet when they buy it. I would actually make it look less like a tablet and more like a controller. I would take some of the edges off and make it less rectangular.
I'd make it triangular.
I would just make it a little rounder, a little curvier. I'd make it look more like an ergonomic gaming controller that just had a big screen. I would remove some of that empty space, a lot of that. See, the thing is, on the gamepad, I think it's kind of bad industrial design, actually, because there's a lot of blank plastic on the surface of the gamepad. And it's not good plastic. It's really kind of cheap, you know, a lot of the materials that they use in that thing. And it makes it look kind of shitty. And it's not, it's a good controller, but it doesn't look nice and it doesn't even feel that great when you first pick it up.
Yeah. Especially when people have become accustomed to iPads and all
of
these,
which are made of glass and metal.
Yeah. These really nice, exactly, glass, metal, these really nicely designed, attractive, appealing to the eye kind of devices that are out there.
Right. Yeah. And frankly, I would probably improve the screen technology. Not in a way that would make it incompatible with anything, and not even necessarily adding any features. I would just make it nicer, you know, just improve the contrast on the screen, improve that plasticky surface that they have there, and, you know, maybe include just a nicer stylus or, I don't know, something that just makes it feel less cheap. So I think there's a lot of things you could do there. And frankly, I don't know. Some people might find this weird, but I would actually kind of double up on Mike's idea. I would probably include the Pro Controller as a bundle with the gamepad also. But you know, just because then it comes with two controllers, and the whole point of the system, you know, a lot of the Project Cafe kind of concepts that are built into Nintendo Land is that you would have two people playing. I would not assume that people, number one, own Wii Remotes, especially Wii Remote Plus, that's required for most of the games in Nintendo Land to play multiplayer. I would also not assume that people have their Wii Remotes handy and that they actually want to use them. So I think including a second controller in the box is a much better play at getting people to actually use the system the way you had intended it to. And then the other side benefit of releasing the sort of GamePad Pro or GamePad Plus or whatever you want to call it, that's just really, it does all the same things. It's just nicer. Maybe it's a little bit smaller, a little bit tighter and more efficiently designed. The screen's a little nicer and all that stuff that I said, is that now you convince a lot of the people who do already own a Wii U, you might actually convince them to buy this controller as an upgrade. Now they own two GamePads. Guess what? That's the perfect time to go back to the well and revisit this idea of games that might actually use multiple game pads for some really interesting kind of off TV secret information kind of gameplay, which has been completely abandoned. You notice you did not hear a peep out of that at E3.
Nope.
Because they're like, damn, we can't even sell people one game pad, much less two.
Yeah, and also we can't even handle making these HD games to begin with, so we're not even thinking about shit like that.
Right, right.
But I mean, I really like the idea of a hardware retooling, though. I mean, because I think that can go a long way. I mean, look at what it did for the DS Lite.
Exactly, you know?
I mean, look at what, I mean, even look at what it did for, I mean, people love the 3DS XL versus the normal 3DS. Love it. Absolutely love it. It's still selling like hotcakes.
Well, and there's precedent. Even on the console, there's precedent. They did the Wii Motion Plus and the Wii Remote Plus.
Yep.
So I certainly don't think it's out of the question. Again, it may not be reasonable to do it this year, though. But maybe next year is, and to me, that's a great way to relaunch your system, as you pack it in with this nice new thing and a really good game, that people actually care about. And all of a sudden, to me, it's far more attractive than it is currently. Because I think I just don't know that, I mean, and Nintendo Land isn't even bundled with all the systems. But even if you're assuming that the system you're looking and considering to buy is a deluxe version that does include Nintendo Land, I think they've already sold Nintendo Land to most of the people who really care about Nintendo Land.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to bundle it with something different. You know?
I haven't had much to say about this topic, but I think that's because starting like next month, I feel like my interest with the Wii U is going to be revitalized. Just with like the games, like they're going to have one a month, and I'm pretty much interested in all of them except for the Wind Waker remake. And even that I might buy because, someone might play it, but,
yeah. And like, what's the first one? Is it Wonderful 101?
Pikmin next month.
Oh, Pikmin's the first one. Yeah. I mean, I'm super
and from there, so. Like I'm not going to be able to keep up. Like there's going to be Wonderful 101. I might check out Sonic, although after E3, I'm not so sure. The demo was poor, but maybe the finished game is going to be pretty damn good. I don't know. But yeah, like Rayman and Mario and Donkey Kong, I'm pretty much getting them all, a lot of them, like one a month from Nintendo. So I think that my Wii U is going to get a lot of play. Sure. I you know, like those ideas to relaunch the console are not bad, but I think that that's kind of what Nintendo is going to do just by having
about having some ads?
That, yeah. I'm sure the ads are coming as well. Like,
really? Because I said that 6 months ago.
Well, 6 months ago it was January. Not the greatest time to try to sell.
Yeah, there was nothing really to advertise. Like, I think they were just waiting.
The system itself.
No, but they're waiting for actual games to advertise.
Yeah, I mean they really haven't had anything to toot their horn about. I mean,
they had a Mario game. They had a game that traditionally sells a billion copies. They could have advertised that. They didn't.
But Guillaume, it sounds like your perspective is if you were Iwata, you would just do what Iwata's already doing.
I'm not a businessman. Maybe Iwata is not either.
Yeah, that's
he's
the thing.
He's not a businessman.
He's a game developer.
Yeah, I mean...
he's a game developer who once thought he was better at it than Miyamoto is.
Yeah, I mean...
he's not even a good judge of talent!
The thing is, he
made fucking
wasn't.
Balloon Fight!
I mean, the thing is, Iwata's like grand plan of, hey, we're going to make a bunch of first-party games, and then third parties are going to hop on board. I hear that, and I'm like, okay, dude, like that's pretty much, you're not telling us anything new. That's what every single console ever, that's what every single first party is supposed to do. That's what you're supposed to do. It's like,
well, also that's what they thought would happen on N64 and GameCube, and it just didn't really shake out, right?
Yeah, and it didn't work before for you. I just feel like Iwata's just kind of naive. I don't know. I hear the stuff that he says, and I'm just like, dude, do you realize what's going on around you? like you're radioactive to third parties just because they don't give a shit about your console and they don't care what games you make. And unless you suddenly out of nowhere sell 40 million consoles, most of them probably aren't even going to look your way, you know?
Yep. So, all right. Well, I think we beat that horse pretty dead, but, thank you everyone for writing in. I do want to mention a couple people wrote very, very good emails about the whole Smash Brothers Melee at Evo thing. And I was all ready to deal with one on the show. And it was a very interesting topic, but it was sort of overcome by events because Nintendo reversed their position pretty quickly. It's a really interesting news story, but I don't know that we can add a whole lot to it right now. So, I just want to give props to people who were very passionate about that topic and wrote some really good emails about it before Nintendo got their mind right and straightened it out. The email address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Write it down, people. You'll be glad you did. And thanks so much for everybody who's been writing in. We will try to catch up with more emails very soon. Also wanted to mention our very dear friend Greg Leahy recently appeared on a new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. It is lengthy, and if you would like to hear Greg expound at some length about a number of games that he really loves, I recommend that you check that out. It is a fantastic episode. Of course, he and TYP listen to a lot of great video game music, and they have some great discussions as well. So do check that out. It's on iTunes. It's also on our website. And I think it's an awesome podcast.
So yeah, I was actually on the episode before that you may have missed because of all the E3 stuff. So we've had a nice RFN trend going on that show.
Yeah.
I don't remember what games we did though. I remember I didn't know what we had going in and I utterly failed.
Failure is part of the fun on radio.
I utterly failed. It was a disaster.
Yeah. Of course, we don't say this very often, but every now and then I like to give out a reminder that we would really appreciate and we would really benefit from your ratings and reviews on iTunes. So if you use iTunes...
I thought you were going to say money.
From your money? Yeah. Yeah. We would benefit from that
well,
also.
Well, I would always benefit from your money, but...
I'm not about to ask for that.
I'm not above asking for money.
But it costs you absolutely nothing to go over on iTunes and give us a rating and write a little quick review of the podcast. If you're so inclined, it would be a big help. And finally, I wanted to mention that I hope we got my fingers crossed right now that by the time you hear this, we will have a new retroactive poll up on the website. So if you've ever participated before, you'll know that's a lot of fun and it leads to some really great discussions here on the show of some sometimes classic and sometimes not so classic video games, but it's a chance for all of us to play a game together and talk about it in unison, in harmony. And I love that
or
feature.
Discord.
So, we are not quite settled on which games we're going to talk about, but it looks like it will be a Wii game theme, maybe overlooked Wii games, something like that. So anyway, there will be a link to the poll on the article for this show. And we'll also make sure that it's very obvious and very easy to find over at NintendoWorldReport.com. So I hope you'll go check that out and vote on it, because there may be a relatively short period for voting because of our production schedule this summer. So please go check that out and help us make Retroactive an interactive and popular feature on the podcast. That's all we got this week. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later. Make love to your ears.